This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic.
Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, you can't that's fit. Not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Should prisoners who are going to be behind bars for their 20s and 30s be able to freeze their eggs so they have the option of starting a family later? Because a woman behind bars in Queensland tried, because she won't be out of jail until she's almost 40 at the earliest, but was denied that opportunity. Do you think that's right? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're discussing this case from an ethics point of view.
If imprisonment prevents you from ever having a child, then this is going to be a kind of ongoing long-term consequence.
Yeah, I'm keen to hear your thoughts as well. I'm sure there's lots of opinions on that story. Also coming up, there's a lot of fiery debate happening in Canberra this week. The government fending off accusations of lying, trying to figure out a way to get their tax changes passed. We'll fill you in. First, though.
Hack. Those in hospitality have a higher stress environment than those doing neurosurgery. Can feel that.
On Triple J.
Hospo workers, how much abuse do you cop on the job? And I'm not just talking about from customers either, although that is a big part of it. I'm talking toxic work environments, whether that's in the kitchen, if it's from a manager, harassment, abuse that's normalised. What's your experience? How bad was it? And did you try to do something about it? Message in 0439 757 555. Maybe the harassment you were copying in hospo forced you out of the industry altogether. We're talking about this because you might have seen in the news recently that one of the world's top chefs from a restaurant called Noma in Copenhagen was hit with multiple allegations of physical and psychological abuse. So what is it like for hospo workers here in Australia? Well, Ariana Lucente has been looking into it, and a heads up, we hear about some heavy stuff in here.
You shouldn't have to feel like going to work is a live or die situation because you screw up someone's coffee.
Dee is a barista in Melbourne.
I have worked in multiple cafes. I've worked fine dining.
She says
the pressures
in those jobs makes everything feel like life or death. So why do some people compare working in kitchens or restaurants to working in an emergency department?
You're grilling this, you're putting things in the oven.
Everything's like loud, there's big lights, there's dinging.
Service for table 10, this one needs to go out.
Juggling so many priorities in your head.
Fred Bartolona is a chef at his own Filipino restaurant, Palai, in Melbourne. He started chef training at 15, so he's used to people yelling in kitchens. But he says there's a difference between yelling for urgency or attention versus full-on verbal abuse.
It's like, you piece of shit, you are ugly. You didn't do this thing right.
I spoke to a bunch of chefs and hospo workers across Melbourne, and they all say abuse in the industry is prevalent. A 2022 study from the University of Queensland found that of 400 workers surveyed, 60% had experienced sexual harassment, verbal and psychological bullying, or racial abuse. So what have Fred and Dee seen?
First time I sort of injured myself in a kitchen, I piped up and asked for advice on what to do, and they let me go from a job and said if I'd said anything, they'd sue me.
This is one of Dee's early experiences, but it's a long list for both of them, including sexual harassment.
That sous chef in particular, he kept on insisting, so are you like gay?
Racism.
His skin color is brown. He probably can't speak English.
Dodgy pay arrangements.
$14, $13 an hour because you're signed up to do an apprenticeship.
And threats around visa sponsorships.
One of the managers, she basically said to me, jokingly, I own everything here, including you.
Fred is from the Philippines and says he ended up getting his Australian visa sponsored by a different employer. But he says that kind of dynamic is common.
And it's very subtle sometimes. You always think a survival is important when you're a migrant, but it does take a toll.
Dee has caught physical abuse from customers, staff, and even her boss. Dee was a few weeks into a barista job, and the cafe that weekend was chaos.
The boss came in because he heard it was such a shit show, whose first thing to do was yell at me, what the hell is this, and swearing, and physically grabbed me and said, you stand right here and make shots and I will steam. And so he's over the top of me, arms around me, and like yelling in my ear. Steaming milk over the top of me, physically in my space. I'm so stressed. I'm already on edge. And it was so much.
Fred thinks it can be hard to raise issues in hospitality environments because kitchen hierarchies can reinforce toxic power dynamics.
Can you stir that pot for me, please, yes, chef? Can you take my knife, chef?
You might have only heard that phrase in TV shows like The Bear, but it's key to the brigade system, a hierarchy that establishes labor division and a chain of command in kitchens.
It's military-like. So when you're in the military, you follow your sergeant.
I'm sorry everyone is in this situation. I really, really am.
That's René Redzepi. A few months ago, he stepped away from his Copenhagen fine dining restaurant Noma, dubbed the world's best, after allegations of physical and psychological abuse from dozens of former workers.
Every time something big happens in the media that is bringing to light some exploitation in hospitality, things get fixed a little bit afterwards.
Dee and Fred reckon that momentum is helping shift the culture.
Some chefs are automatically an asshole because they were trained to be an asshole.
Some changes are being made. In New South Wales last year, new reforms were introduced to make it easier to suspend liquor licences or remove certain people where inappropriate behaviour wasn't appropriately addressed.
That kind of magic when you're cooking, it gives you a sense of wonder.
After a tough ride, Fred feels lucky he's able to set the tone at his own restaurant.
The language and the behavior. I don't call my team staff, I call them team. We got each other's back.
Hack on Triple J. Arianna Lucente reporting there. And look, so many similar stories coming through on the text line now, also on Hack's Instagram. Bree saying yes. All of this, especially pub culture, left the industry after some awful experiences, Bree saying. Maya saying, I worked in hospitality and it was genuinely so hellish that I feel too scared to go back to anything but barista work. I think about my time as a waitress and I feel traumatized, verbal abuse, constant harassment from other staff and customers, as well as unbelievably long shifts in environments that felt like everything was life or death. And Sean saying, every kitchen I ever worked in was an absolute nightmare. You couldn't get away with 1% of what most chefs and owners do to their staff in other industries. Yeah, there's some really, really intense stuff that we're hearing. I want to check in with a union perspective now, because obviously a lot of young workers might be a member of a union, might be seeking support from that avenue. And with us is Tim Kennedy. He's the National Secretary of the United Workers Union. G'day, Tim. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, we know your union's actually done some research in the past on the mistreatment of HOSPO workers. What has it found? Like, is this as widespread as we're hearing?
Yeah, I mean, our research was a number of years ago, but I have to say that nothing much has changed. What we have in Australia is a normalisation of exploitation of Australian young people, especially in their first jobs, and it creates a situation where stress and abuse is seen too much as a rite of passage in this country, and a lot increasingly is through harassment and sexual harassment at work and bullying. And that happens too often. And we all have experiences of it ourselves when we were growing up, that people are told, well, this is a rite of passage to work in Australia and you've got to suck it up. And we think it's a product, we would say, of the embedding in our country of inequality.
Yeah, I mean, and we're hearing now from those who work in HOSPO who say it doesn't really matter if you're working in a really high-end place, a fancy restaurant, or if it's a cafe or a small bar. Like, people are copying this in all kinds of venues. I mean, what would the union like to see to tackle this problem?
What we've found is it's quite diverse where it can occur, and a lot of it hinges on what type of employer you happen or lucky to meet. And what we've said for a long time is that we do know, and we have evidence for this because we organise in this area, is that where you have active unions and workplaces and where employers acknowledge that it is legitimate human right to be part of a union, we have safer workplaces and we have workplaces where people paid appropriately. I would like to be able to say to you there is a legislative response to this. There are good laws on the books, but when you have a normative view in this society is that you can exploit into your court, it's an ongoing problem. So we do need to kind of have a collective change of thought about these things, about what is normal, what is acceptable, and how do we actually understand that unless you treat people with dignity and respect, you'll have growing inequality and you'll have a repetition of exploitation from one generation to the next.
Well, look, thank you very much for coming on and having a chat with us. Tim Kennedy from the United Workers Union. Appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.
And yeah, look, still so many messages coming through on this. Someone saying, hospitality work gave me a level of work trauma I cannot forget. The stress-induced eczema, anxiety attacks, micromanagement, it was horrendous. Another person asking, didn't one big celebrity TV chef basically get famous for verbally abusing people on television? Yeah, well, look, it's definitely something that's been around for a while. Let's get another take on all of this with someone who was in hospo but now works on the other side as an employee counsellor. Dariel Bowne is from Wanderlust Hospitality and she's with us right now. Dariel, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thank you so much for having me and giving light to this. I feel like conversations about this are important.
Yeah, we're hearing some really hectic stories from hospo workers. And I mean, you're someone who started off in hospo yourself, so I'm guessing it's probably not too surprising to hear these things.
Oh, unfortunately not. Unfortunately, it's not too surprising. My experience in the industry, there were high highs and low lows. And I think the industry is fun and exciting and dynamic and no 2 days are the same. You're constantly kept on your toes and that's exciting and fun. But there are parts of it that are a lot lower and are not really conducive for like a healthy lifestyle. But yeah, even myself, I was exposed to a lot of like mistreatment by employers, even, you know, experienced sexual harassment and sexual assault from a manager I was working with. So I've hit a lot of the lows in the industry and I'm now super passionate about creating environments in which people feel safe enough to speak about the stuff that's really tough in the industry.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a really positive thing that you're able to do that and go into workplaces and talk through a lot of this stuff and get to the heart of what is often going on and the dynamics at play. I mean, it does feel like a lot of good workers are abandoning hospo just because they can't put up with this stuff, which is fair enough. Do you feel, though, that workers are getting a bit more comfortable in coming forward and speaking up about some of the abuse and harassment they're copying?
100%. And I think there's been some people that have kind of led the way with this. We're getting a younger generation of people coming through the industry that are a lot more like staunch and strong in their voices, which is such a beautiful thing. And they're feeling a lot more comfortable speaking up when something doesn't feel right or when they've been mistreated or something horrible has happened. And so, I mean, the younger generation are definitely pushing this movement towards it being okay to speak up. But I think it's just also being televised, it's being broadcasted enough for people to understand that there are now consequences to really unethical business practices and not treating people right. And I think that's giving people a sense of safety to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's like TV shows as well that really display the kind of atmosphere, the environment people are working in, and some people say that's romanticising it. Other people are saying, no, it's a really kind of realistic view of what's happening, and maybe that is also helping people understand, you know, what is normal, what is not normal. Dave Marchese, this is Hack. I'm speaking with Dariel Bowne from Wanderlust Hospitality, and we're talking about hospo workers and the kind of abuse and harassment that they're copping in the workplace and hearing so many of your stories. Someone saying, I have a deep-rooted fear of bosses because of a job I did in my formative years. Sexual harassment was totally normalised. Another person saying, yeah, I was harassed by a co-worker who was a friend of the boss, reported the harassment, and the boss cut my hours because I wasn't smiling enough. So some really horrible stuff we're hearing, Dario. I mean, on a more positive side, have you seen workplace cultures turn around dramatically? Like some of the places that you've been able to work with, have you been able to sort out some pretty hectic issues?
I think so. I think just the mere fact that hospitality owners and operators are prioritising their staff's well-being by employing me and getting me involved in supporting their people. You know, EAP is something that is utilised in so many other industries. I mean, I'm sure, you know, ABC and everything has government organisations have access to EAP, other industries do as well, but hospitality has never really had access to it. And so, you know, a lot of owners and operators now even know what EAP stands for, which is a great thing. But no, there's definitely some progressive, more forward-thinking, game-changing business owners and operators out there that are trying to do better by their people, by educating them, getting programs like this involved in their workplaces, and just like treating their humans like humans and remembering that they are in fact humans and not machines that can constantly be smiling but working through insane amounts of stress.
And also, like, from a financial point of view as well, you would think, like, obviously you want to be creating a safe workspace for everyone, but from a very like business point of view, if you're treating your staff well, they're going to be doing a really good job. And I know, like, some of the employers that you've been speaking with, Dariel, have made that point that it's an important part of all this is to make sure that we are treating our staff well, so they do want to work here and they do want to do a really good job.
I think, yeah, like at a bare minimum, you know, just treat your staff kindly. I think that should be just a base standard for any sort of workplace. But unfortunately, yeah, the culture in the industry the bar has been so low for so long when it comes to treatment of staff and what they've had to put up with over the years, that we've got a long way to go. Yes, there's been progress, but that bar is still a little bit lower than I would say other industries, and it's still got a way to go.
Well, look, thank you very much for joining us and having a chat. Dariel Bowne, EAP Counsellor, owner of Wanderlust Hospitality, really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
And we've got a lot of messages coming through. Someone saying, I'm a 30-year-old chef. I was in the industry for 10 years and was diagnosed with severe generalized anxiety and major depression. I'm now a supermarket checkout chick and sometimes work the bakery. Best change I ever made in my life, which is interesting. Sometimes you just need to make that change. And someone else saying, I was an apprentice chef for a year before I left completely. I was not able to cook dinner or even do the dishes for a long time afterwards. I got harassed. I got made to hold boiling hot plates. Got asked how much I'd charge for an hour of sex, all when I was under the age of 18. I tried telling people, but everyone told me to suck it up. I ended up quitting being a chef and I'm now an apprentice carpenter, and I can say that I've been treated with more respect as an apprentice carpenter than I ever was as a chef. Yeah, look, some really, really terrible experiences coming through. I just want to remind you, if you do need to seek some help, some support, Lifeline is always there on 13 11 14. There's also Full Stop Australia and the National Violence and Abuse Trauma Counselling and Recovery Service. It's on 1800 385 578.
Hack. Proposed curbing of tax breaks for property investors provoking mixed reviews in a quickfire two-day inquiry.
On Triple J.
The government's still got a battle ahead to win support for its proposed overhaul of the tax system. Since announcing the changes to capital gains, negative gearing in the budget a few weeks ago, you would have noticed this big backlash from business groups on social media, some worried about what these changes will mean for them. In Parliament, there's been this two-day inquiry looking into the government's plans, as political reporter Evelyn Manfield explains.
Maybe you should table your book, because, of course, you've argued for these changes also. So these
have been a lot. That's not true. What
a fiery clash on live TV this morning.
People around the country are screaming for help. And your answer to this, lied before the Australian people before the last election. You're now ramming this through the Parliament.
Labor Minister Amanda Rishworth and Liberal MP Tim Wilson fighting it out over the government's major shake-up to the tax system, which is the subject of a two-day inquiry. As you might remember from last month's budget, the government wants to change the discount applied to capital gains tax. That's the tax on money made from selling an asset like an investment property, shares, or a business. The government also wants to limit negative gearing to new builds. That's when, say, you're making improvements on your rental property and you spend more on it than you earn, you can claim that loss and pay less income tax.
If you want to invest in a negatively geared property, you can do so, but it's got to be a new build.
The idea, the government says, is to make the tax system fairer, no matter if your income comes from a wage or an asset. The changes are being picked apart at a Senate inquiry where a bunch of stakeholders are sharing their opinions, like Jacob Kane, the boss of the Real Estate Institute.
These reforms do not build more homes.
He's questioned what the changes could mean for the 7 million renters he estimates Australia has. That's because the government's own figures forecast the changes will help 75,000 people into home ownership over a decade, which he reckons isn't all that many.
That's effectively equivalent to 1 in 100 renters. The other 99 will be left in a rental market with fewer homes and higher rents.
But progressive think tank the Australia Institute believes the changes will benefit young people saving for a home, even if they have to pay more tax on their share portfolio, because house prices are expected to cool. Here's senior economist Matt Grudnoff.
If these people are saving to buy a home, they're going to be far better off from not having to pay a fortune for the house and get into housing early, rather than the tiny amount that they might lose from additional tax.
You've likely seen online the budget's been getting a lot of heat. Comedian Dave Hughes has been going off.
The capital gains tax. If I had have known they were going to do that, I wouldn't have voted for them. I voted for Elbow and Chalmers. They didn't have a mandate for changing capital gains tax.
While others back the changes, the negative commentary has certainly had cut through. According to a survey published in the Sydney Morning Herald, about two-thirds of people don't reckon the budget is good for them or the country. Now, back at the inquiry, business professor and former head of the competition watchdog, Graham Samuel, says the negative talk's been dominated by big business.
Private vested interests have got very, very good megaphones, and they'll march up and down the street with their megaphones and their signs saying, yeah, this is going to be disaster, woe betide us. The public interest is very rarely represented.
Associate Professor Sonali Wolper, whose expertise is on tax policy, also has backed reform.
The CGT discount is a massive tax expenditure.
She says the capital gains tax discount costs taxpayers nearly $22 billion a year.
For more than 25 years, it has contributed to inequality in Australia. Most of the CGT discount benefit goes to high-income earners.
But the Business Council's Brand Black says it'll amount to a handbrake on investment and productivity.
It is a rushed, piecemeal process that bypasses the comprehensive policy development that Australians deserve for major reform.
Senators will now write up a report based off the inquiry. As for the legislation, it still has to pass the Senate, where Labor needs support from others in Parliament, and that could mean changes or carve-outs.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Evelyn Manfield reporting there, and pretty sure we'll be hearing a bit more about these tax proposals in the next few weeks.
Hack.
It's a question you probably never even thought about. Should prisoners have access to fertility treatment?
On Triple J. Yeah, this question might seem simple, but I'm sure there'll be differing opinions, and I want to hear what you think. Should prisoners be given the option of freezing their eggs so they can potentially have children when they get out of jail? Because a recent court decision in Australia has got people talking about this. When a prisoner applied to undergo an egg extraction freezing because she's not due out of prison until she's in her 40s, but was denied. I want to find out a bit more about this. And with us is Julian Coplin. He's a lecturer in bioethics at Monash Uni. Julian, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
You're very welcome.
What else do we know about this case in Queensland?
We have a woman, Smith, in her early 30s, who's serving 10 years in prison, and she was wanting to self-fund and undergo egg collection and egg freezing so that she'd be able to increase her chances of falling pregnant once she is eventually released. She applied through ultimately several different kinds of courts to be allowed to access this. But in the end, each of her applications was rejected because Queensland prisoners are prohibited from accessing assisted reproductive technology, and egg freezing was thought to fall within that scope. And what this means for her is that when she is released, her chances of conceiving a child is much lower than it would have been if she were permitted to freeze her eggs, and potentially something that she might value a lot, and that a lot of us value a lot. The opportunity to become a parent might end up being unavailable to her.
It's a really interesting case, and it's hardly just Australia that this is being discussed. I saw in the United States there are also big discussions around this. Prisoners themselves writing opinion pieces saying, I'm trying to get this done, but it's not allowed, and I don't think it's fair. Could the outcome have been different, Julian, if this prisoner was serving time in another state in Australia?
Yes, absolutely. So my colleagues and I, when we were looking into this case, we had a look at what has happened in Victoria, and there are at least two cases that we've come across where women in prison in Victoria were permitted to access IVF while in prison. So this would be quite a bit more than undergoing egg freezing. This would be undergoing fertility treatment, actually falling pregnant while still in prison. And so what this means is that if you are imprisoned in Victoria, you're able to access something that goes quite a bit beyond what Smith was trying to get access to in Queensland. But if you have the misfortune of being imprisoned in Queensland, your options are much thinner. There's much less available to you.
And is that because in Victoria the laws are just different, or there's just a different consideration for these practices when it comes to human rights?
Yeah, the laws are different between different states in Australia. And I think this kind of raises a question about, well, what's behind this inconsistency? Do we have a good reason to treat this differently in Victoria to Queensland? Or could it be the case that one of these sets of legislation is making a mistake and we should maybe try to be fighting for one of them to be adjusted?
We've got a few opinions on this one. Someone saying if they've got the money, who cares? It's their choice. Another person saying it was your offence. Obviously bad enough to be imprisoned for a significant amount of time. So of course you lose the chance to have kids, is that person's opinion on the text line now. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with bioethics lecturer Julian Copland about egg freezing and whether prisoners should be able to get this done so they have the opportunity to have a family when they get out, when they've served their time, on the back of a case in Queensland where a prisoner was denied that request to get her eggs frozen. Julian, it feels like a really interesting case for someone like you, a bioethics expert, to look into. What were some of the issues that you were focusing on when you were exploring this case?
So there are two really key concerns that worry me and, you know, my colleagues who I wrote this piece with, Molly Johnson and Neera Bhatia. One is about the scope of punishment and what we want to happen when we punish someone and imprison them. You know, imprisonment is meant to achieve something. Exactly what it's meant to achieve, different people will give you different answers about that, but usually in Australia we think in terms of things like rehabilitation and in terms of protecting the community and in terms of the kind of temporary restriction on some of your freedoms. But this is meant to be restored on release. The difficulty for people like Smith and others in her position is that some of the consequences are going to be ongoing indefinitely. If imprisonment prevents you from ever having a child, then this is going to be a kind of ongoing long-term consequence. And this isn't one that we would willingly inflict. We no longer sterilize female prisoners, and nor should we. So the fact that we have policies that are imposing more or less the same kind of outcome on women whose fertility is declining over the course of their imprisonment, I think should really worry us.
And presumably there are sex discrimination considerations here because men would not be facing the same pressures in the sense that many of them would still be able to have children once released, even if they are middle-aged.
Absolutely. So male fertility does decline a little bit over time, but not nearly to the same extent. And a man who's jailed at the age of 33 and released at the age of 41 is really probably not going to face many struggles creating a family and having children. This isn't the case for women. So even though the rule in Queensland isn't exactly discriminatory in the sense that both men and women are denied access to assisted reproductive treatments, the consequences are very different for men and women, and they're much more dire for women that are invested and would like to have a family after release.
Well, thank you very much for coming on and giving us your take. Julian Copland, bioethics lecturer, I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
And still a lot of messages coming through on this one. Someone saying, of course, she should be able to freeze her eggs. Another person saying, IVF treatment while in custody, how ridiculous. Well, we're talking about, freezing eggs, maybe not full IVF treatment. Someone else saying, don't do the crime, don't do the time. Maybe harvest your eggs before you commit an offence, is that person's opinion. It's someone else saying, I guess it depends on the crime and if they can pay for it, but maybe they should have thought about this before committing the crime in the first place. So few very strong opinions there on the text line. Also hearing from a lot of people on HOSPO abuse as well. Some of the stuff that we're hearing from you that, you know, you've encountered in your first job especially is really, really troubling. That is all we've got time for on Hack for now.